Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the Indiana Athletic Trainers Association podcast, hosted by the Young Professionals Committee. The views and opinions expressed by speakers, guests, or others who have provided materials to and for this podcast are not necessarily those of the IATA. The IATA assumes no responsibility for, nor endorses any of the comments, recommendations, or materials that are provided. Do you need CEUs? Check out the IATA website, where you can find a link to EBP Central, working in collaboration with athletic trainers to continue Indiana's tradition of excellence.
Welcome to the IATA podcast, the official podcast of the Indiana Athletic Trainers Association. I'm Scott Sell, the IATA Communications Chair, and I'm joined today by writer, author Will Carroll, formerly of Sports Illustrated, now of the website Under the Knife. Will, thanks for joining the podcast.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, Scott. I really appreciate it. This is certainly a cause and a career I can get behind.
Awesome. We appreciate you. We appreciate you joining us, and we're excited to hear your story, how you got into writing about injuries and what you know about athletic training. So before we do all that, give us your background, Will, kind of who you are, how you got involved in the injury side of sports, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. I usually have to start off by saying I'm not a doctor or an athletic trainer. And with this one, I think that's pretty clear. Unfortunately, I'm not an athletic trainer, but I've been around it my entire life. My father is an athletic trainer, worked with pro college teams throughout his career, just recently retired, had been at the University of Mobile as their curriculum counselor. I forget what the exact term is. I've basically grown up in locker rooms and training rooms, was a student trainer myself, and never went through the whole testing procedure. It just wasn't the career path for me, but I understood it and I spoke the language. So when I went into sports writing 20 years ago, that's where I found my niche. I could understand what the doctors and athletic trainers were talking about. I could explain what a sprained ankle is. I can explain the difference between a sprain and a strain, why a sprain is a tear, still the bane of my existence. But that's where I kind of found my niche, explaining what was going on the field to all the people who don't understand it, because doctors don't have the time. And unfortunately, athletic trainers aren't often allowed out to, you know, explain the injuries and give those kind of things, because there's only so many hours in the day. So, I've written for ESPN, for Football Outsiders, for Sports Illustrated, as you mentioned, Bleacher Report. Now I'm doing my own thing at undertheknife.substack.com. It's a newsletter where I can kind of have a one-to-one relationship with my readers. But it's doing the same thing. It's explaining what's going on in the training rooms around Major League Baseball, the NFL, and the other professional sports leagues.
It's fascinating to hear kind of that story and how this came to be. I'm sure your dad appreciates the light that you've been able to shine on the profession. For many of us, we feel kind of this unknown entity in, yeah, the healthcare spectrum, right? And so I'm sure for your dad, looking at what you're doing to advocate for us as a profession, that's pretty special, I would assume, for your old man.
Except for the times where teams have like called him thinking it's me or vice versa. I get those quite a bit. I think it's certainly the knowledge and passion that he had for the profession pushed it towards me.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we look at is we were going to ask, like, what do you know about athletic training and stuff like that? But sounds like you kind of grew up in the athletic training room, learning to tape ankles, learning to do those evaluations and all those things. So you're well-versed in what we do, even though you're, right, you don't do what we do. So
Exactly. And a lot of people have always said, well, you're not one of these things. You're not a physical therapist. You're not a chiropractor. There's a whole lot of things I'm not. But I don't ever pretend to be that. I'm not going to get in there and tape somebody's ankle up. I could, but you wouldn't want it. I was never that good at those. I think what I have is that language. if I start talking about an anterior drawer test or, you know, a milking sign or all these other things that athletic trainers think about or actually don't think about, it's just part of their everyday lingo. If you say one of those to somebody who's just watching a football game and wondering what's happening to their favorite player as he's laying there on the ground and somebody's tugging on his knee, that's really where I was able to. It's also, you know, being able to speak that language makes it possible for athletic trainers or doctors that I speak to kind of speak their language to me and let me translate it, rather than with a lot of other sports writers, they've got to say, okay, this is this and this is that, and kind of walk them through the process. With me, they've come to know that they can kind of speak their own language to me and trust me to get that out to the people.
When you got started into the sports writing gig, did you see yourself writing about injuries? I mean, you said you kind of found your niche, but yeah. I'm wondering if that was a hard sell to the editors of all those places you've written for. Let me write about injuries. Like, I can't imagine that's a thing that editors would want to talk about, especially maybe 20 years ago when you got started. Obviously, injuries are much more part of the conversation nowadays, but I'm sure 20 years ago that may have been a kind of a taboo topic for you.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I didn't come up through journalism school. Like I said, there's a lot of things I'm not. Sure. I came out with, you know, the pre-blogging era where we were, you know, typing on forums and things like that. So, yeah, it wouldn't have been an easy sell to an editor. Luckily, I was found by Baseball Prospectus. One of the founders, Gary Huckabee, brought me in. At the same time, he brought in Joe Sheehan, who's one of the great baseball writers around, and this other kid named Nate Silver. I don't know what happened to him.
Yeah.
Thought he would do good things. but it's one of those things where I've basically been lucky along the way. You know, being on TV at ESPN was a great experience. Writing at Sports Illustrated, when it was still Sports Illustrated, was a great experience. So to me, it's being able to tell the story of these injuries, to understand that, you know, no, this guy isn't soft because he's been out 3 weeks with turf toe, to understand what these athletic trainers and other allied health professionals are doing out there and why it's so difficult to come back from injury or prevent injury. That's been my privilege for the last 20 years.
Yeah, you know, and we are certainly grateful for the light that you shine on the profession and the expertise that you lend. And I think a lot of people would echo this, that having somebody who can understand us, like you mentioned, and then being able to decipher that for the general public is super helpful, because it's often hard for us, or we don't even get the chance, right? I think the Kansas City Chiefs are one of the few teams that never had an athletic trainer to have a press conference. Well, maybe that's something that more teams should look at to peel back the curtain and allow us as a professional to talk, but also to shine a light on what their athletes are actually going through.
Absolutely. I think that is a great, great point. You know, the work that Rick Burkholder does out there in Kansas City is amazing. And it's never once, obviously, put them at a disadvantage. I can remember a couple of years ago, I was in the car, I forget where I was driving, but they had a press conference with him where he explained Dontari Poe's back injury. And he was like, here's where it happened. Here's what we did. Here, we tried to avoid surgery. He ended up having two opinions. He had surgery yesterday. Here's when he's going to be back.
Yeah.
Dead on. And, you know, it literally happened that way from the time he said it to the time he was back. Right. You know, it was all, I think it was 6 weeks, and I think it was 6 weeks to the day. It's just one other team doesn't do that is beyond me. I realize maybe they just don't want to put in the time. If that's a thing, I don't know. I know that coaches are really bad at it. You know, you get things like, he's got a knee, he's got a back. Well, yeah, we know, but what's the injury, sir? I wish more would do that. I wish at the college level, that was something we saw. You know, obviously at the high school level, it's normally not a media situation to begin with, but even there, I think it would be a great outreach for an athletic trainer to quickly and you know, efficiently say, here's the issue. Of course, the other issue in high school is that there's not an athletic trainer at every high school, which is a problem in and of itself.
We'll talk about that in a second. Obviously, Will, you've been writing about this for 20 years. Have you ever seen anything like what we're going through right now with this COVID pandemic? I mean, for us working in healthcare, let alone as an athletic trainer, just any of us in healthcare, in my 10 years, I've been doing this 10 years, I haven't seen anything like it. You've been writing about injuries for 20 years. Like, can you even compare this to anything that you've seen over your career?
Yes, but it's different. I mean, obviously this is different. I remember back in, I want to say it was 2003, 2004, when SARS was hitting. And a guy I'd worked with, Keith Law, was in the front office of the Blue Jays. They were having trouble getting people to come downtown to come to games. And one of the things they had pushed was, yeah, we're going to let everybody in for free. Or maybe they had to charge a dollar, something like that, and a Canadian dollar at that. But they just wanted to get people back in the stands to show them it was safe again. Sure. And, you know, sell a couple t-shirts, sell a couple hot dogs and beers. And it worked out really well. And it showed people that, you know, if you're just smart about it, you can be safe. I wish we would do something like that again, because if everybody wore masks and washed their hands properly and just generally weren't idiots, then we could be back out there the way we've seen in England, in Britain, in Korea. New Zealand has obviously been one of the leaders, but I don't think anybody's really watching rugby union down there.
Correct.
So it's just an issue of, is there anything like this? No. It's the uncontrolled growth. It's the push against the science and the willingness to do small things like wear a mask or stay inside. That we haven't seen before. The fact that we're going to have to go back to school here in the fall without a real national plan, without a vaccine, without a good testing program, that's like nothing we've ever seen before, and it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, as we look at this, right? So all the high schools in Indiana started conditioning this week. Colleges are starting to return. Obviously, NFL training camp for the Colts is going to happen here within the month. Like, what does sports look like in 2020 and beyond until we get that vaccine? Like, I wonder, does everybody that come to the game wear a mask and we tape off 6 feet in between each other? Or what do you think this is going to look like just from a pure spectator standpoint? And then we'll talk about the actual delivery of healthcare during COVID and all this.
Yeah, Scott, I wish I knew what this was going to look like. You know, it's kind of crazy. I mean, first, I think everybody needs to be wearing a mask. If you're out in public, wear a mask. I think it was Connecticut or New Jersey. There's an eastern state that's going to require masks for any time you're basically outside the home. And I think that's a great move. But of course, we've already got lawsuits against it saying it's encroaching on their freedom. Okay. So I just don't know. I know that, you know, when baseball comes back later this month, we're going to see fans in the seats in some areas. How many? Texas is saying about half. You know, I just don't know. Are they going to require a mask? If it's an outdoor stadium, I don't know. How do you do, especially for sports like the NFL, where almost all seats are sold to season ticket holders? How do you say, you know, we're going to be apart? You've got to sit, you know, 3-4 seats apart. I just don't understand how that's going to be possible. Do you tell, you know, you get the even games and the other guys get the odd games? I simply don't know how that's going to work. I was actually talking to somebody today with an NFL team, and they're talking about selling advertising on empty sections of the seats. And one of the ones I heard was it's going to be the first 8 rows. And I was like, those are pretty good seats. How are you going to tell somebody to move? And he's like, social distancing, keeping them farther back from the team, so they're not going to get a choice. And I was like, okay, so you're going to sell ads, and you know, say you can do it because of social distancing, and yet the fans aren't going to be that. You know, you're going to see, you know, some idiot in Buffalo jumping through a table at a tailgate, not wearing a mask. It's those gatherings where we don't have a lot of control. I would hope that the Colts and the Pacers and every other team out there says anybody coming through the door wears a mask. I would be okay with that. It's those other gatherings. The bigger issue to me is not baseball, which is doing a lot of testing at its own locations, or the NBA, which is doing this Orlando bubble. I think it's going to be colleges and high schools. You know, can we get enough tests down there to make it reasonable? Are kids going to have a test to come back to school? That's one of the things I've seen some colleges, including Purdue, is doing. And that all makes sense. But once you're there, it's not like college kids are in a bubble. It's the opposite of a bubble. If we can't get sufficient repeated tests, I don't know how we're going to have sports that involve any sort of congregation, and that's all of them.
Right. I think for me, who's worked in the collegiate setting and now leads a program that outreaches to high schools, those are some of the outstanding questions that we have. Is there a testing policy? Can we even mandate it especially at a secondary school level? How do we do that? Do we do that? Two, we don't know the ramifications of COVID enough yet to understand, do we need a return to play policy? Is this kind of like a concussion policy where we need a 5-step progression? There's still so many unknowns. And to your point, our metropolitan cities have a lot of testing and some rapid tests, but can you mandate to high school in a 500 person town that all their kids need testing when the closest testing site's an hour away? I don't know. So to your point, I think there's so much that we don't know, and that to know that most schools are going to start back to school in 5 weeks is a little nerve-wracking for those of us working in healthcare and those of us writing about healthcare. So let's talk about the delivery of healthcare in COVID. What are you seeing from the professional teams, and what application do you think that has down to the low college ranks and even the high school ranks? What are some of those best practices that you see at the professional level that maybe can be adapted to the rest of us?
Yeah, you know, it's always been an issue at the professional levels. You know, when you have in Major League Baseball 2, maybe 3 athletic trainers, in football, it's a bigger staff. In basketball, it's a smaller staff, but there's a lot of allied professionals that help with that. The issue has always been manpower, you know, or really not manpower, but man hours. You know, there's only so much time in the day. Athletic trainers do sleep now and again. They occasionally have lives outside of the training room. So it's figuring that out. You know, if you've got to do extra cleaning, if you've got, you know, more paperwork that you have to file, if you have to go and get the testing kits and drop them off at FedEx every day, you're just adding and adding and adding. You take that down to the collegiate level, and that's just not tenable anymore. At the high school level, I think it's actually the reverse. You know, we spoke earlier about the fact that not all high schools have an athletic trainer on hand all the time. I don't think that's going to be tenable at all. I think if you're going to say that coaches are going to do temperature checks before practice, you're opening yourself up to all sorts of liability issues. Coaches are not athletic trainers. Coaches are not medical professionals. If you tell me the school nurse is going to be out there doing it, I'm not buying it, because she or he has a million other things to do, and adding athletic care to that is just not tenable when you're talking about, you know, fall sports or winter sports where there's multiple sports going on at a time. I think the athletic trainer is designed for just that kind of role. And instead of dropping outreach and community health programs, as I've seen some systems do, I think we're really coming to the point where if you want sports at your high school, you're going to have to fund an athletic trainer. First off, it's not that much. It pays off. But if COVID hasn't shown you the need for it, nothing is going to, and you should just disband the sports program.
That's fascinating to hear you say, because you hear a lot of athletic trainers saying on Twitter, like, hey, if you can't afford an athletic trainer, why do you have sports? And while I tend to agree with that, there's also budget restrictions and things like that that the high schools have to face. Do you think COVID is that break-even point for these high schools that don't have an athletic trainer to say, hey, it's now or never? Like, if a high school doesn't get an athletic trainer now, what do you think could force them to get an athletic trainer in the future?
Yeah, I can't imagine anything being worse than this. You know, this is kind of the moment where if this doesn't do it, you've just decided you're not going to. And that's okay. If you're an athletic director and you're just adamantly against it, fine. I've never heard one say that out loud. It always comes down to budget. And yet they always find budget for new things. I know there's a high school nearby Indianapolis who has a turf field but no athletic trainer. And it was like, okay, explain to me again how you don't have budget. Sure. So those kind of things always happen. And I think when you take a look at it, I think there are ways to do it. Do you need one there at every contact practice? Yeah, I think you do. I don't think there's a way to share them amongst the community. Even outreach programs aren't ideal because, in a lot of situations, it's one for multiple sports. I know there's a school, again, near Indianapolis, that'll go nameless, that has one athletic trainer on duty during sports practices. He's not out there with the team. He's just like on call, I guess.
Sure.
Which I get, if you only have one and you've got three or four different practices going on, I guess it's better than nothing, but not much. It's just such a difficult situation, and it all comes down to budget. But if all it comes down to is budget, how much do parents care about their kids? We see travel baseball where the fees are $10,000. Okay, fund an athletic trainer, because if anything needs one, it's those travel teams. All these sorts of situations, if it comes down to just money, I think, heck, you're probably going to make it back in insurance premiums. Ideally, I would put them at school level. I understand that outreach programs and hospital shares and things like that are necessary, but certainly no knock against it. I just think it would be ideal would be one at every school. And depending on the size, two or more is certainly better.
You look at some of these ratios. So let's take the Colts, for example. I think they have five staff athletic trainers for a roster, an in-season roster of 53 athletes, plus or minus some on the practice squad, plus or minus some on the injured reserve. Compare that to Ben Davis in Indianapolis, has 6,000 students and we'll say 1,200 student athletes, right? So Ben Davis may have three athletic trainers on staff for all those 1,200 athletes. Mm-hmm. So you go from a ratio of 1-10, 1-12 with the Colts to 1-400 at Ben Davis.
Right.
To your point about being on call, Ben Davis might as well have a university campus. Like, are they truly able to cover? No offense to Ben Davis High School, I don't know what
anything
is there, but are they truly able to provide athletic health care to the best of their ability when they're running around in a golf cart all afternoon?
Yeah, exactly. And it's difficult. I think they do as good a job as they can. I think the athletic trainers are just making the best of a bad situation in those situations. Luckily, they have student trainers that can help with those things, at least offload mixing the Gatorade to them. Situations like that. I mean, yes, I never want to knock a school for not being perfect because, in Ben Davis's case, at least they're trying. At least they have somebody on staff. There are far too many of the same size that don't have nearly the same resources. And for the smaller schools, again, I understand budget issues, but I'm a firm belief that even at the youth level, if a city has a youth football program and you don't have an athletic trainer on staff who's there every day, heck, I know I know so many college athletic trainers that would love to make $50 for sitting at a youth league football game for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. 90% of the time, nothing's going to happen. But, you know, the other 10%, you're going to do a couple concussion checks, somebody sprained an ankle. That would be a great thing for them to do, especially student athletic trainers. Within limits, those are the kind of things they can handle. And getting them out there in the community is, again, a great way to build up the profession.
Yeah, I think we look at the future profession, right? We're moving to a master's degree and master preparedness, and I think that's really going to help elevate the profession. But we are handcuffed a little bit by some of these state practice acts and being certified and allowing these students to do too much. But I think there's an opportunity, to your point, of getting them some exposure early to some different areas that may be underserved, right? And if we can kind of have a grassroots effort, that's what I was talking about in the high school setting, like, your high school athletic trainer is going to be the first person that traditionally introduces you to the profession. So,
right.
Well, one, if you don't have an athletic trainer, you don't even know what the profession is. And two, if you have a really unfortunate bad experience with your high school athletic trainer, you may question your future athletic trainers all the way through your athletic career. That could really detriment the profession. So, I think it's a really interesting time to be an athletic trainer, right? We've seen cases across Indiana, across the country, of athletic trainers being furloughed or athletic trainers being laid off because sports were laid off and things like that. So as we move forward in this new post-COVID life, in your opinion, what's the viability of the profession if sports get shut down again, knowing that the bulk of athletic trainers work in traditional sports settings? Some of us are moving into healthcare administration or physician practices in the military and things like that. So we're not just sports people anymore, but we're still a traditionally sports heavy profession. And if sports don't exist, what happens?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. And I do think that we're seeing the value of what athletic trainers do. I think the further we get from sports, the less we get from the profession itself. I know this expansion to make sure that they're a health professional and the clinical setting is necessary. Right. But, you know, there's always been this crossover between physical therapists and athletic trainers. And physical therapists do their thing. I've always thought athletic trainers do their thing. I don't really like the idea that there's a whole lot of crossover, because I felt like it was two different professions. I realize a lot of people have both degrees. I realize physical therapists think they can do everything. But with athletic trainers, I think the further we get from sports, the further the profession gets from sports, the worse off it's going to be. Because I've always felt the value is in dealing with the specific athletic demands of a sport, of understanding the team, of understanding the demands, of understanding what it's going to take to get him back, and making those decisions. I think the best scenarios for athletic trainers are when they're involved in one of those, either preventing an injury, I can remember my friend Ralph Reif, who's at Butler now, when I'm blanking on the kid's name from Louisville, who broke his leg during the NCAA tournament.
Kevin Ware.
And what was that?
Kevin Ware.
Kevin Ware, that's right. So Ware goes down, and it's horrible. He's fine now, so we can talk about it. But, you know, his college career essentially ended. But there were three athletic trainers, including Ralph. I go, oh, look, there's Ralph, running out to take care of him. And that was a situation where, you know, Mike Krzyzewski couldn't even look at the leg. It was that gruesome. But they knew what to do. They were right there. They didn't know Kevin, but they were able to deal with that situation, put him in a situation where he had the possibility to come back. I can remember people tweeting with me as that happened, saying, is he going to lose his leg? What's going to happen? And I was like, no, he's got the best athletic care he can have right now. That's the kind of situation where everybody should have access to that kind of care. Everybody should have the best possible people around. And I think situations like that are where athletic trainers should be proud and put those forward. And I think there's got to be a way to get those successes out. when somebody comes back from Tommy John surgery, man, there is a surgeon, a physical therapist, and an athletic trainer that have been involved with that one from day one. And I think they ought to get more credit from that. When somebody comes back from an ACL surgery, again, it's probably all three that you need to really get back. And I don't think those stories are being told as well.
Right. You know, I think you mentioned the difference between AT and PT. And I think the thing that sets us apart is that we have that acute injury management piece that Ralph so well exhibited when Kevin got hurt, right? So now we're the one healthcare professional that sees these athletes, these patients, from their worst moment when they get injured all the way through that process, right? No other healthcare professional can say that, hey, I was there at the moment you got injured, and I'm going to walk you through this entire process. I may even be in the operating room with you. I'm not going to do the surgery, but I'm going to be there with you so I can see it, so I understand what you need done post-operatively, and then I'm going to get you back onto whatever playing surface you're going back to, and we're going to walk hand in hand, step by step, every part of this process together. Like, to me, that's the value of athletic training that is so hard to put into data. It's so hard to put into analytics, right? You can't put a number per se on that experience. We're getting there. We're getting some good analytical data that says, hey, by not going to the rehab, the PT clinic, you saved X amount of dollars and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you're starting to see some traction with some of these schools who've never had an athletic trainer, that we actually have some numbers now that back up that anecdotal story that says, hey, we can walk this entire process with you. Well, now we can go to the school and say, hey, two athletic trainers in high school provide almost $3 million in services annually. Mm-hmm. That's a whole lot of tax savings for your parents, for your taxpayers, for your school corporation. Why don't you have one, let alone two or three or four or five? So I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that I always think about is, you know, back decades ago when I played high school football, we were all scared of that ambulance that sat at the end of the field. Nobody wanted to even look at it because it was sort of an acknowledgement that something bad could happen. But the athletic trainer, we liked him. He was the one that brought the Gatorade. He was the one that had the good tape. So, you know, with one, you can have a positive experience, and the other, which every school has on mandate, at least for football games, you know, that was always seen as a negative. And I always thought athletic trainers needed to find a way to get more positive interactions out there just like that.
I'm perfect. Sorry, you took me up perfectly. For the general public, right, for those aren't involved in athletics, or mom and dad who has Johnny in eighth grade football and doesn't know a lick about athletic training, like, what are the most common misconceptions you hear about athletic training as you write about injuries, and how do we help dispel some of those misconceptions?
Yeah, I think, again, it comes down to time. You know, when you have a chance to explain the profession or an injury, I think athletic trainers have a duty to do it. Too many times they're seen as an impediment, I guess it would be, to something that this guy's not letting me come back. It's almost never that situation. I think parents need to see it as, you know, a real health professional. This is, you know, somebody who is working with the doctor, with the physical therapist. This is the person that's on the sidelines with them. And those kind of interactions really help. I think the fact is, you know, the name itself has been problematic. Too many times people don't know what a trainer is. They think, you know, he's the guy in the corner with a boxer. Personal trainers have done a better job marketing it. I've always thought that name should be changed, but I think that ship has sailed. The other one that bugs me on Twitter is if somebody refers to an athletic trainer as just trainer. Back when we only had 140 characters, that was it. A lot of people would drop that off. And the first interaction a lot of media people have with an athletic trainer is them whining that you didn't call them an athletic trainer. Fix the name and we wouldn't have had that. Again, that ship has probably sailed, but please don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, like, that's an opportunity for us as professionals to say, hey, Will, here's who I am as an athletic trainer. I'd appreciate the opportunity to further explain to you so that you can better understand why we like to be called an athletic trainer, not a trainer, right? Attacking you on Twitter isn't going to do anything but make you have a vendetta against the profession and probably not like not give you any reason to change the way you refer to us.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't think it works even in that nice way that you put it, because honestly, most writers or announcers don't care. You can see which ones have actually taken the lessons. Sure. But it's one of those things where if you're only going to have one interaction with a person, that one's not the one to pick. There's a lot of different ways to do it. But that said, I think we just have to find better ways to get the word out about who it is that athletic trainers are and what they do. There's never been a movie about an athletic trainer. There's never been a major fiction book where it's been a major character that I'm aware of. And for the most part, most writers don't speak to the athletic trainers. The Colts are one of the worst examples of this. They flat out cannot speak to the press at any time. And think about how many times they could come out and say something or just, offer tips about how to acclimate in the heat or right now with COVID, saying, here's what the Colts are doing. Here's what we're doing in the training room. Here's what we're doing with the field. Here's how we're keeping the turf clean. And we'll see whether they do it. But my guess is nope. Situations like that, where you can get out in the community and show your expertise, I think those are great. Not everybody wants to be in the media, but not everybody has to do that. But find a way to amplify your voice, help somebody else. And I think that's going to be good for the whole profession.
I think that's interesting you said that. Rick Burkholder, obviously we've talked about him before, but him yeah. and I are on the NATA Public Relations Committee. And one of the things he says is, I love the media. I love talking to the media, and I will do it any chance I get. Some of us aren't comfortable with that. I would be comfortable with that, but a lot of us are used to being kind of this behind-the-scenes character mm-hmm. who plays an important role, but I don't want to talk to anybody. So to your point of, and to Tori Lynn's point, our NATA president, hey, we need to show our AT impact. We need to show how we are healthcare. I think that's an excellent point that you make of, you've got to be willing to talk and you've got to be willing to share your story.
Yeah.
So that you can advance yourself and your profession.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I realize, I don't know the exact number, but everybody always says that public speaking is one of the biggest fears that people have. Remember, in 99% of encounters, the media does not want to do anything other than get its 10-second soundbite. They don't want you to give a speech. They don't want a PowerPoint. They don't want anything other than, who are you? What just happened? Those kind of things. And building up a relationship is obviously one of the best ways to do it. If you're in a sport where the media covers your sport, you have a chance to have some sort of relationship with that writer, with that TV guy. And that's a great thing. If you can say, hey, Mr. Sports Writer, the athlete that you said, the big recruit went down with a knee, he's going to be fine. Here's why. Here's what we saw and here's what we went through. We think he's going to be back next week. That is a great way to show exactly what the profession does. Are you violating anybody's, privacy? No. Everybody has a HIPAA waiver for something like that. Be upfront with it. I mean, there's a lot of times where more information comes in behind the scenes. Everything is going to leak. But I've always wondered, especially at the college level, why there wasn't more of that upfront, because I think that would be a great place to do it. I think the problem is that even at the athletic department level, a lot of these guys, especially the old school ones where the athletic director was most often an ex-coach, they didn't really understand what the athletic trainers did, other than they were the guy who told them who couldn't play. I think the idea that we could have more people like Rick who get out in front and give the information is something that a lot of people react to. And I think that's definitely got to change.
You know, even at the local level, so I'm in small town Indiana, and we have local media who cover our events, and I'm always going up to them, hey, I'm happy to talk to you about an injury. Just let me know what you need, and I'll give you the most HIPAA compliant information that I can, because I want to make sure that the information being disseminated is as accurate as possible, right? We don't have writing about high school sports, but I do have my local sports guy writing about sports, so that's the best option I have. So let's make them as educated as possible as we can. So
absolutely. And you know, there's always going to be that day where he's got column inches or whatever the internet equivalent is now to fill. And you can, here's a story about a guy who isn't playing, but we're going to have him back for next year. Pitching story ideas, or, you know, here's four student athletic trainers, and one of them is going to go to the University of Indianapolis to be an athletic trainer someday. Story ideas like that are gold to sports writers. Right. We love getting stuff like that, and because it makes us, it gives us kind of less thinking, which is always good.
You know, well, as we look to wrap up our conversation, and I think there's a lot of value to both athletic trainers listening to this podcast as well as the general public. I'm curious, why don't you think ATs get the attention that the other allied health professions do? Right, we always hear about a physical therapist or a nurse, but you don't always hear about an athletic trainer in the mainstream media. I'm curious why and how we, and we've touched on, but how we as a profession help to change some of that. Like, what do we do to improve our brand, if you will, in healthcare and in the mainstream? Like, how do we become the nurse equivalent in athletic healthcare?
Ooh, that's tough. I mean, with nurse, I think even kids understand what a nurse does. So I would say it has to start with getting the idea of the profession out there so that people understand what it is. I don't know how you create kind of a history for the profession. I mean, it exists, but you know, if I say Florence Nightingale, you know what she did. If I say Clara Barton, you know who she was. If you know, I can go through nurses in popular culture all the time, especially these days. And thank God for their service in times like these. Not knocking nurses at all here. Big fan of nurses. Right. I think what athletic trainers need to do is, first off, not be scared of telling a story, and they have to build out that story. I worked on a story a couple of years ago trying to find out who was the first athletic trainer in professional baseball. And it's a dead end. There was absolutely nothing I could find. I think I figured it out, but the problem was that he really had no training. He sort of did some things. He was more like, I'm honestly not sure if you wouldn't call him a massage therapist these days. And he certainly wasn't trained for that. So it was a story that just died, but it always stuck in the back of my mind that nobody knows this history. You know, who was the first NFL athletic trainer? It's not a story I've ever followed, but my God, shouldn't that be an easy Google search? You know, who was the first female athletic trainer in X sport? Who was the first female certified athletic trainer? I don't know. And that seems like something important to know. Having that sense of your own history helps to define the profession. And then the other thing that defines it is how well it deals with change. I think as bad as this COVID situation is, I think it's a chance to really step forward and say, here's what we can do. Sports are important. Sports are coming back. How can I take a leadership position in safely bringing it back to keep my athletes safe? I think the other thing, and this is going to be difficult, but I think there's going to be an athletic trainer somewhere that says no. I think there's going to be a situation that's not safe, where they feel they're seeing people with symptoms, where they're just going to have to shut it down. And that's going to be one of those Norma Rae moments, because nobody likes being that guy. But it's the right thing to do. So I think this gives the whole profession a chance to step forward and show who they are.
Yeah, especially as we, again, like, sports are here. Sports are ramping up. Everybody's coming back this month or next month. And it's an opportunity for us to step out of the shadows and really say, hey, here's how we managed COVID for our athletes, and here's all the other things that we do for our athletes beyond COVID screening and temperature checks and things like that. Did you know I did Adrian Peterson's ACL rehab? Did you know I got Teddy Bridgewater back from that gruesome knee injury, and now he's the starting quarterback for the Carolina Panthers? Like, how did, so to your point, getting those out there, because I'm guessing a lot of people associate Teddy Bridgewater's recovery with a therapist, right? The PT. But I'm confident that the athletic training staff of the Vikings did the bulk of that therapy.
Oh, absolutely. The fact that they got him off the field, you know, they didn't know that he didn't have any nerve or vascular damage, but that, Eric Sugarman did just an amazing job with that. One of the things I always say is, when if you have fans of a team, any sport, can you name your athletic trainer? And why the heck not? Because in 90% of the situation, it's not, which just shows how much opportunity there is to really get the name out there. So, heck, get out there.
Right. Yeah, and you know, you're talking about writing a, there's been no fictional character featured as an athletic trainer. I think that's your next book idea, Will, is to write a book featuring an athletic trainer as a primary character. I think you're onto something there.
You know, I've thought of that. The problem is, and this is a minor thing, and though it is part of the issue with getting out there, I don't think athletic trainers are glamorous. I think it's by design. These are just hardworking people that want to do the work, and yeah, there's hardly any stories there. Not to say there aren't stories, because as you well know, anybody that's ever been to the NATA convention and been in a bar knows there's a million stories. I'm sure there's a book there.
Right.
Maybe. Somebody has an idea, contact me.
Yeah. Got it. There you go, guys. You got a story idea or pitch for Will Carroll. We'll make sure we link his website and everything in the podcast notes and things like that. So, Will, again, really, really appreciate you coming on. I appreciate what you do for sports injuries, for the profession. Any closing remarks you have for athletic trainers or the general public about athletic trainers?
Thank you. The other thing that I don't think the athletic training profession gets is enough thanks for the hours, for the low pay, for the work you do, for the things that go beyond your real job, for all the times you had to ride a bus for a game you weren't going to play. Thank you. I think every single one of you deserves a whole lot more than what you're getting, not just in terms of a paycheck, but in terms of thank you. So if you're one of those general public people, if you're a parent, if you're an athlete, every once in a while, just remember to thank your athletic trainer for what they do, even if they're not taping your ankle at that very moment.
Awesome. Will, again, really appreciate it, guys. Check out Will's website, Under the Knife, Substack.com. Will, did I get that right?
Yeah, undertheknife.substack.com, and it's free right now, would love to get a whole lot more athletic trainers on there to correct my errors.
There you go. Awesome. And Will, you're active on Twitter?
Unfortunately, it's at Injury Expert.
Okay, at Injury Expert, undertheknife.com.substack.com. Will, appreciate it. Thanks for what you do, and hopefully we'll have you back on soon.
Definitely. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Indiana Athletic Trainers Association podcast, hosted by the Young Professionals Committee. The IATA would like to thank elite sponsor Methodist Sports Medicine and bronze sponsors Ultra Ankle and Myotech. Be sure to follow the IATA on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube for information on any upcoming events.